that gets us down in letter B on the outline on page 14 to the sins of idolatry and sorcery, two specific sins. And you'll notice that he puts as a kind of a conclusion, these sins are perversions of worship and drugs. And the point being with the sorcery, that sorcery in the actual Greek term, it is the term from which we get pharmacy or pharmaceuticals, the idea of drugs, and it's the use of those drugs as part of witchcraft. So it's a specific kind of witchcraft that is being considered here. And you know, the inclusion of hallucinogens and things like that. Point is that drug use is something that is combined in this term. And the abuse of drugs, I think, in principle, we can very clearly see would be condemned in Scripture. But this is a term that actually would deal with it. I think that any of the passages concerning drunkenness would likewise apply to the use of illicit drugs, in the sense that they're used to be mind-altering, which is, of course, the appeal of alcohol. So alcohol is, in fact, a drug, and other drugs would be likewise condemned based on that principle. This is a term that actually refers to it. Drug use was not unknown, though alcohol, no doubt, was the drug of choice. Drug use was not unknown in that time. And the taking of those drugs was commonly associated. Like it is, I mean, you have, for example, with the Native Americans, the use of a drug called peyote, and the fact that that was supposed to be done in what is referred to as a vision quest. And it was something that allowed, it's a hallucinogen, it allowed your mind to be altered as a part of a process of gaining wisdom. That kind of thing is what's under consideration here, and would certainly be condemned by God as one of the lusts of the flesh. But again, I think the principle could be true with regard to any illicit type of drug, even if it's recreational use, because of the aspect of it being mind-altering and coming under the influence of it would be just as ungodly as doing it with alcohol. Whatever causes the drunkenness, whatever illicit drug is the cause of the loss of control, and the loss of self is something that would be condemned by God. But this passage, I mean, this word would certainly be inclusive of drugs. Now, additionally, it is the practice of what we might refer to as dark arts. I understand that things have been limited, but there is still a great appeal for the occult among, well, even in our society. I mean, it's certainly something that the use of, quote, magic, and even if it be illusion, the appeal to sorcery and to witchcraft and those kinds of things is very prevalent in third world countries. Yes?
Probably 15 years ago, a long time ago, I was at the Weatherford Public Library and I saw a copy of 17 magazine, which is, you know, for young girls. And when I was a kid, it talked about nail polish and, you know, and the front cover of this magazine 15 years ago said, "Witchcraft, the cool new religion."
Yep.
Targeted to 13 to 14 year old girls. It was very frightening as far as I was
concerned. It is. That the Wiccan religion is supposedly a worshiping of nature to a great extent, but it's also supposed to be empowering with regard to the feminism.
Yeah, it's very matriarchal.
Yep. And it really is. It has been popular over the last few decades. I think it probably remains a fringe thing,
yeah.
but it's something that would have appeal.
Yeah.
It is. It's amazing. That's, I think, an indication as to how we've reached that idea of toleration. You know, when we, as a nation, we're based on Christian ethics and the Judeo-Christian ethic, but we've reached that idea of toleration, where it doesn't matter how kooky the religion is, that all are considered equally valid in the minds of many. Which in effect indicates, because of the exclusive claims of religions, that if you accept each as that is equally valid, then there's no validity to any of them. And I think that's why our society is as it is, because people have started playing at religion instead of actually having strong convictions about right and wrong and truth and error and sin and righteousness. It's just that instead, just kind of what are you interested in a way of looking for, quote, enlightenment or something that suits you. And it's really a shame it's gotten there. But that would be an example. Any kind of a pagan thing such as that, the Wiccan, but the occult is something that when you look at our, it especially appeals to the young. I mean, most of the horror shows and movies that refer to occultism and such are basically directed to young men as their audience primarily. And there is an appeal to that with regard to the young. But any type of cult activity is something that would be condemned by the term sorcery as well. And by the way, when you talk about sorcery and idolatry, you can see how the two are tied together. I don't remember, I know if you are familiar with the Greek mythology of the Delphi Oracle, called the Oracle of Delphi, and there was a claim among the Greeks that it was in Delphi, but there was a fissure in the rock, and gas comes up out of the fissure, and there were some young females who were the priestesses, and they were able to foretell the future. Well, the belief is, and they actually have found that kind of evidence, is that there was the gas was hallucinogenic. In other words, they were getting high and hallucinating, but it was something that was very important to the Greeks early on. So idolatry and the use of drugs is something that's not uncommon as you look in various cultures and such. But when you look at some of the practices of the Greeks and Romans associated with their idolatry in the temples, this kind of action would not be uncommon. So these two can often be tied together. Now, with regard to the sin of idolatry, no sin is condemned with more frequency or vehemence in the entirety of Scripture than idolatry. Jehovah God is one, and the worship of any other god than Jehovah is something that is condemned both in the Old Covenant as well as the New Covenant it's very obvious and very, very forceful. Without exception, we are to worship God only. But that would be, of course, something that they would be very familiar with. So that's one of those in the list that is just kind of an obvious one as to being a god. But I would add that, and I think Colossians 3 is the reference to that, that covetousness is idolatry. So while we would say to ourselves today that, well, we're more sophisticated than that, worshiping graven images, anything that obtains a place of preeminence in our lives is put before God, becomes an idol. If we do not put God first in our lives, then we are guilty of idolatry. That's why covetousness is idolatry, because your attention and focus and desire are for whatever it is that you covet. Whatever that object is, it gains that place of ascendancy where it becomes a god to you. And why the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, because an individual who makes money his focus, his priorities are skewed, his life is a mess, but he has made money his god, and the filthy lucre his god, and that type of thing is likewise idolatry and sin. Alright, anybody want to add anything to the letter B? Apologize for the noises, it was much worse yesterday, but they've already finished the banging on the tops. They're scraping the bottoms now, the flat parts of the roof. Letter C, there are sins that violate the law of love. Now, what this indicates, as you look at these eight, why they are categorized. Now, this is an arbitrary categorization, by the way. In other words, he's simply trying to group them together in each. But it's a valid point that there are often things that individuals do that by doing them, by definition, they violate the greatest or most important law that we are given to follow, and that is the law of love. Now, abide, faith, hope, charity, these three, the greatest of these is charity, as we read from 1 Corinthians 13 last time in our studies. But the law of love is a law that governs every aspect of our lives. It should be the single animating influence with regard to any decision or action that we take. So if I am going to do something, the first question should I ask is it going to be edifying, or is it going to be injurious to another? If I'm seeking their welfare, I'm seeking what's best for them, well, that by definition would preclude my hating them, preclude my contending with them or striving with them, preclude jealousy and all of these other things, because these things by their nature are hurtful toward others rather than helpful and edifying. And love requires that I be helpful and edifying rather than hurtful. So it would be simple to put those, and perhaps in some sense we could put all of them in there, because adultery and fornication is hurtful to others as well, and idolatry is certainly indicating a lack of love for God. So I think all of them, perhaps all sin, could be put under that. But these are pretty specific with regard to how they impact another, and how that impact is negative. When we talk, for example, about hatred, some of these again are words that we know and understand. Others are a little bit more difficult to define. But hatred, I forget exactly who it is that said this, or but it was concerning obscenity and the definition of obscenity. And of course, with regard to obscenity, people have a hard time legally defining what obscenity is in order to keep obscene things lawfully excluded from the concept of free speech. But people have often said when the court is trying to define what obscenity is and letting things in that are obviously obscene, I know it when I see it. That's I may not can define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. There are a lot of things that are just obscene and you can see it. Well, hatred, you know when you see it. If an individual is a hateful individual or has hatred in his heart, those feelings of hostility and rage and enmity that you have with another individual is something everyone recognizes. And hatred, of course, is something that is sinful.
That's pretty much a waste of time. It is.
Sorry.
Having a place in your heart to put hatred.
It's one of the least productive emotions that you possibly can have. Distracts us, and it's always something that is damaging and injurious to another person. So that's a horrible thing.
Well, it's as bad on the individual who hates, really. It's like a cancer. If you harbor that in your heart or in your mind.
Yeah. And there are other sins that we can make note of where the origin of those sins is hate. Racism would be an example, and any other kind of prejudice, murder, some of these other things that we mentioned. They often emanate from a heart that is overtaken by hatred and darkened by that. And that, in fact, when we look at some of these other things that are in the list, it will a lot of these do come from that hatred that an individual might have. Contentions would be an example of that. When we talk about contentions, we are told, for example, in Jude the third verse, to contend earnestly for the faith once we're all delivered to the saints. That's not what it's talking about. I've had individuals who have told me that religious debates are sinful because we should not be contentious, and they missed the point entirely. Contentiousness, as is rightly defined here, is strife, quarreling, discord, and contending for the faith is not strife or discord. I mean, when you contend for the faith, it's an attempt to maintain the unity of the Spirit and bond of peace. But you have to defend truth. You have to defend what is right against those who are purveyors of evil. this is evil itself. It's intrinsically evil. If an individual hates another, and so he's arguing with them, or he's fighting with them, that type of an evil action, which it derives often from that hate or enmity that exists in the heart, is something that itself is sinful. Now, I can
understand a person having witnessed some debate saying they were evil.
Yeah, now that's the caveat, because there have been many religious debates to where the individuals who are participating in that debate were contentious.
But if you're debating to determine what is right and what is wrong, I think they're a good thing, but I've seen them. Very hateful debate.
And that's sinful.
And so, was anything good to come out of them? It was offset by the behavior, you know.
Yeah. And I think as a society, we've lost the ability to communicate and disagree without being contentious.
Yeah.
Can't stand those news programs. They talk on top of each other. I just want to say, be quiet. Let him say what he wants to say. You can say what you want to say.
Right.
So, overall, we have become a more contentious nation.
Very much so. Yeah. And that is exhibited and has been exhibited through in religious debates in the past, mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a shame.
But discussing things to come to an understanding is a very good thing.
Yeah, you're right. All right, the third point under letter C is jealousies. And jealousy and envy are two things that really kind of... they're very synonymous. They're very close in meaning. And it's sometimes difficult for me to really be able to differentiate between the two. And you know, the definition that he gives here of the two would indicate that envy is kind of an escalation of jealousy. And but you'll notice he says jealousy is a zealous envy. So it's kind of a degree of envy that often casts grudging looks. But then you go down to envy, it says, like jealousy, but that which expresses itself in hostile deeds. And I'm not sure if that's legitimate. I guess I should have looked it up before. But again, I think we can see it when we see it. We can recognize what it is. An individual who is a jealous individual. And by the way, as part of this, these definitions, you'll remember in 1 Corinthians 13 the statement that love does not envy. But what it all has to do with is my reaction to another who I perceive to have something or to be someone or to be in a circumstance that I consider as being good, beneficial, to be desired. So if a man, if I as a man see another man who is married to a beautiful woman, then I could be jealous of that individual or envious of that individual. Same thing with regard to money or possessions or those kinds of things. Instead of being, is what love would require, being appreciative. When one rejoices, all rejoice. Which is the law of love and should be expressed in our Christian faith, of being happy for another and thankful for the blessings that they received. Instead, I look at them and I am envious of them or jealous of what they have.
Besides, who could have a more beautiful wife than yours?
That's right. That's right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I should have gotten to that a little quicker. But that kind of a thing, and that's why we talk about, now when you're talking about like a jealous husband in the sense that I don't think we use that term. I don't think that's, maybe it may be have some origin that's very similar, but there that would be more of a paranoia than it would be really jealousy in the biblical definition of the term. You know, she belongs to me, and I'm paranoid that somebody's going to try to take her away from me. That's when you talk about a jealous husband, I want you just for myself. Well, the man has the right to that, and those kinds of things. But there's a paranoia and a lack of trust for the wife, and other things that come in with regard to that. So that jealous husband type thing, that use of the term is not very, very much like what we have here. What we have here is something that violates the law of love in the sense that when others have something that we consider positive, we should be rejoicing for them. We should not be wanting to take it away from them. We should not be acting in ways to destroy them or to injure them as a result of what they have that we don't. And that's where jealousy and envy comes in, is that kind of a response to the possessions of others, to the fame of others, to their circumstances in life. All those things can be a cause for jealousy and envy. And those are very, very similar sins. But there are, you know, two terms that are used here. And again, if you look at these things, you know, an individual who sees what another has and they are grudging toward that, then they're jealous. If they act upon it in some way, that can be an expression of jealousy that would lead or would be seen as envy. So I guess, you know, that definition would be as good as any, but those two are so tied together, it's kind of difficult sometimes for me to differentiate between the two. Almost always when I say that person's jealous, I could say that person's envious, and I'd be right on both counts. So they're very tied, very much tied together. All right, question or number four under this, outburst of wrath. Again, an obvious thing. An individual who is lacking self-control with regard to his temper, and that temper flares. And of course, wrath is something that is a bit beyond anger. It will be an outburst, again, that's injurious. Now, it could be simply verbal. You hurt somebody with your words. But an outburst of wrath could also be something that is physically violent. But it's something that is indicative of a lack of temperance on the part of an individual. Selfish ambitions, that we have something that animates a good portion of our society today. Me. What do I get? And what should I do, or how can I get to a point where I get what I want? That type of selfish ambition is certainly something that's characteristic of our society, characteristic of, you recognize it in the business world, for example. It's a part of kind of a natural outgrowth of capitalism. You have individuals who are successful as capitalists, often, it doesn't necessarily have to be the case because you got a lot of philanthropists and others, but often the reason why they're successful is because they're only out for themselves, and they're willing to do whatever is necessary to accomplish what they want. But again, you can see evidences of this even in children with regard to selfish ambitions. I mean, popularity contests and school cliques and all the way up. This is something you learn very young. But that idea of looking out for myself and concerned with myself, that's an immature and an ungodly attitude. Dissensions. Again, when we talk about contentions and dissensions, there are very similar terms, but with dissensions, the idea of a dissension is a division. Contention is the striving, actually arguing, whereas a dissension is a faction or a division. So the literal term means to stand apart from someone. So an individual who dissents, disagrees, well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But an individual who characteristically is one who is a divisive person, one who likes to be a part of a group. Dissensions would be, an example of dissensions would be in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where some were saying, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. Well, they were standing apart from one another based on nothing doctrinal at all. These individuals were all standing for the same thing, but I like to be a part of my special group, and I want to be different from everyone else, and that is a dissension. And that's something, again, you can see it throughout our society. It has, there, it certainly is something that rears its head in the church as well, in various fellowships. So that's something that's sinful. Heresy, or heresies, are factions created as a result of dissension. So I'm I've got the conception that the inclusive in heresies is a concept of doctrinal differences. I'll have to do a little bit more study on that to make sure of that. But again, when you talk about an individual who is a part of a group that does not have its origin with God, because of some application of a principle or some belief, that individual is a heretic. That individual is one who has departed from truth. And I think that there is something that is intrinsically indicative of one who has departed from what's right. He's a part of a faction that is not in accord with truth. But I'll have to look that up and determine for certainty as to whether that's included. And then the last one is envy, which we've already discussed. So does anybody have any questions or comments about any of those that are mentioned in the verses? Okay, and I'll try before next week to look up the term heresy and see if there's anything else in that he didn't put in the definition. And then the other is the sense of intemperance. Now, when intemperance is discussed, that's that indicates the idea of temperance is control. So intemperance is a lack of control or a lack of self-control, which I think outbursts of wrath could be put into that group, certainly, and hatred as well. But here we have actual activities that are activities of excess, murders, drunkenness, and revelries. And you'll notice he says murders are not found in the oldest manuscripts, which means that perhaps in the original autograph it wasn't contained. Yes or no doesn't matter. Murder is a sin. we can, there are plenty of other places which indicate that is the case. But when we have murder, we remember with regard to this that murder is the unlawful taking of human life. The legal distinctions that we see in our society today really are, I mean, they're known of in the Old Testament as well, but talking about manslaughter or justifiable homicide, these kinds of things. There is the accidental taking of human life, which we might refer to as manslaughter, I suppose. But there were provisions that were made in the Old Testament about that, where without volition or without will, a life was taken. There were places where an Israelite could flee in order to escape the cities of refuge, that he could to escape the avenger in a situation like that, at least until judged. But the idea of murder is the unlawful taking of human life. And the reason I bring that up is twofold, just to make that distinction, but also that often you will hear any taking of life as being murder, or taking human life as being murder. This kind of thing, this, for example, list such as this would be used as an argument against capital punishment, which, you know, regardless of whether you're for it or against it, think that it's beneficial or whatever, you know, the text of Romans 13 indicates that God gives governments that right. And so it's just why you commonly see that whenever people are objecting to states executing criminals, that they'll say, you know, the Bible says not to murder. Well, that's certainly the case, but that's not murder by definition. It's not. But the unlawful taking of human life is what murder is.
I guess we should discuss Bin Laden here.
Oh, no. Open that can of worms. Yeah, that's a good point, Tippy, because I'll just give you an example of a problem that I've had. And I actually wrote this on one of these social networks. Facebook is the one I'm thinking of at the time. When that happened, you'd be amazed at how many people weighed in on his death. His killing Twitter. I was told that Twitter's another social network, but the traffic on Twitter, in other words, how many people were posting to it, was the greatest that it's ever been in the history of Twitter. As a result of this, everybody talking about it. And now there are two things come up: is were we just as a nation of going in there and doing that? And then secondly, how is we as Christians? How should we feel about his death? And I must say, personally, that I was very much taken aback by what I saw some Christians writing concerning his death. Because this is a soul that is lost as a result of that. I understand he's not going to... He wasn't going to convert to Christ.
My feel on it was that I'm not sad that he's dead. He killed lots and lots of people and our own people. But I dislike the revelry that goes on at a person's death, and a soul is lost eternally. I don't think it should be, we should be at a picnic celebration.
Yeah. Yeah, when I turned on the TV, and I was up that night when it was the announcement made, and watched for a while afterwards, and the gatherings at the White House and New York at Ground Zero, and people just singing and dancing, and the chant that I heard, which USA, USA, I don't have a problem with chanting USA, USA, but they were singing that song, na-na-na-na, na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye, and you know, giggling and laughing and all that kind of stuff. Just,
and it's just a sad thing.
It is. It's so inappropriate. It was inappropriate. Now the second question, which is something you alluded to, as not being in disagreement with, is whether the United States, whether justice was done, and whether the United States would be authorized to do that. And I think certainly that Romans 13 would indicate they did. And this is the execution of a criminal is what it was. But those are difficult questions, both with regard to the waging of wars, parts of Christians can have in the waging of wars. Those are things that people, brethren, have disagreed with, and that. But again, whenever you have the agency, which is the state, which is engaging in activities such as this, it can be argued as to whether or not the action of the state in a particular instance is righteous or not. In other words, whether God's going to condemn them. For example, if the state comes in and if police officers were to storm this building right now and take us because we're having a Bible study and execute us as a result of that, which of course is an absurd thought right now in our society, but has actually been the case in other fun times. Well, the state, in effect, has the right to enact laws and to execute and such. But what that would be an unjust thing, because we have... It's like with Pilate. He said, he's not done anything wrong as far as I can see. And they said, crucify him. So he did it. You know, it was an unjust thing. We can argue the injustice. But as far as the right of a country to engage in those activities, that is, in fact, the institution that God has given for that purpose. And so that's the distinction between me, someone in my family is killed, and so I take a gun, and as a vigilante, I go and I execute the individual who's guilty or who I believe to be guilty. As vigilanteism, there's no justification for that. But if that person is arrested and executed, the state has that right, and it is not murder, where what I had done would have been. And there's the difference, because of the institution and what God has granted that institution the authority to do.
So, we hear all the time we can't take the law into our own hands, and that's a truism.
Yeah.
We need to hate the sin, but not the sinner.
Yeah.
That's a hard separation. Sometimes.
It's especially if you have someone as ungodly as he was. Okay, so anyway, that's, it's kind of interesting when Tibby brought that up. The reason I said, oh no, open a can of worms, is because the discussion has been raging by many. But I think that sometimes as Christians we simply are caught up in patriotic fervor, and I understand it. He was certainly an evil man, but our response should be a measured response, and the religion, the world in general is not measured in its response with regard to those things. As Christians, we ought to.
Well, I certainly don't think that revelry produces a good cause for Christ in the worldview. You know, because people do think of America as a quote Christian nation, and they're seeing this. Well, look what those Christians. I don't think it's appropriate. I do think we have the right to execute the law, but the joy in it.
Well, and that's why I'm very much appreciative of the response of the way in which it was handled, or has been at this point handled by the government. And I think this serves as a very striking contrast to what you see with regard to these terrorists. I mean, you know, let's videotape the beheadings and then, you know, put it on YouTube, and let's parade the bodies in the streets and these kinds of things. It's what you see. Well, you know, they were concerned about the response, and it's a political expediency in part, but they sought to take care of the remains of bin Laden in such a way as to be in keeping with their traditions, their cultures. Washing the body and wrapping it in a sheet and all the things that they did. It's interesting, they were trying to find a way of burying the body without having a shrine that they could be rallied around, but at the same time not violate the Muslim law. And I think they may have missed that just a little bit, or at least there are some who are objecting to the fact that he was buried at sea, because there is some aspect of Muslim law that while burial at sea is allowed for Muslims who die while at sea, burying a Muslim at sea who died on land is something that's apparently a violation of their law, or their religion. So there are some problems there. But they're, you know, hesitating to show pictures. They're having to try to weigh whether or not showing a picture would be inflammatory, which it certainly would be, but whether it would be sufficient to quell any views or thoughts that maybe he's still alive, which is already kind of among some of the Muslim factions. They didn't really get him, they're just saying they did, type of a thing. But at least there's a measured response, and there was a gravity among the leaders that I was very much appreciative of and expected. I mean, I don't expect anything differently from our nation, but that certainly, you know, to see secular men who are in our nation's government that are responding more evenly and appropriately than some of my Christian brethren is a little bit bothersome to me, because there was a bit too much happiness and rejoicing and merrymaking with regard to his death that I was comfortable with. We're about out of time, but I did want to just look at the last two, revelries and drunkenness. There's also a text in 1 Peter chapter 4 which deals with these, where they have is drunkenness, revelries, and banquetings. And thing to keep in mind with regard to this term revelries is that it is inclusive of alcohol. So these are two sins that have reference to the intemperate use of alcohol. And if you're going to make a distinction, and this is why I think in 1 Peter 4 we can weigh in against social drinking, because you have three gradations that you have there. You have, again, drunkenness, and then you have reveries, then you have banquetings. And the idea is, as Christians, we shouldn't be falling down drunk. We shouldn't be going to frat parties. And we shouldn't be involved in social situations where there's alcohol. That's kind of what he's saying. So it's kind of three different levels. Well, only two of the levels are mentioned in this list. But revelries would be that kind of thing, a keg party, or people who are getting together to quote party, and alcohol's being a part of that, and going to excess and losing control, and you know, I don't remember what we did last night. I can't remember because I drank so much. You know, the drunkenness is the falling down drunk. Revelries may be a little bit below that, but it's more referencing the type of places, bars and things like that, the type of people that are there, and the type of activities and such that come as a result of that. You know, revelry would be something that would lead to sexual immorality. A revelry would be something that would lead to civil unrest. A revelry would be something that would lead to breaking the law in some other way. You know, those kinds of things, because you're losing control. You're out there to go wild. And I mean, you see the, you know, girls gone wild, or you know, going to a toga party, and you know, some of those kinds of things that you see on the in college. And spring break would be another example of revelries.
They say they go out, we went out, had a good time, we're drinking. Hey, have a good time. We fall down drunk. Yeah. I don't know that one.
And how do you know it was good when you can't remember what you did? Because you got drunk. Okay, we'll talk about the application in 2 weeks, and that will be on the 18th. And what we'll try to do is to go, again, we'll probably skip over a little bit of the fruit of the Spirit, because when we talk about the cut context, we've already discussed the flesh, lust against spirit against the flesh. And what we'll probably do when we get through this, we'll go immediately into the fruit of the Spirit, and go and look at the various attributes. And I think again, within those final 2 weeks, we'll be able to sufficiently discuss the fruit of the Spirit and the applications of both to where we'll have sufficiently covered the material and be able to start on a new one, the Community of the Spirit, when we come back in the fall. So we'll pick up there on the 18th. It's the 18th. Today's the 4th, isn't it? All right.
Sorry about the lawn.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, that's
immoral from cat order.
Well, that's okay. That's kind of what we do here on Wednesday mornings. Open them up whenever we want to. But it just struck me, because you'll have, and some of the Christians are they're arguing, but I think they're missing the point. They're arguing that, you know, this, he was an evil man, and it's right. And their idea is it's right to be gratified, feel gratified, and be happy about the fact that justice is done. Fine, that's fine. But what was being expressed was not that, you know, where they're dancing on his grave.
I'm kind of sad about the whole thing.
I think we should be sad about his soul being lost.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've reached this point to where there's such discord and strife in the world. But I do think that we can rejoice in the fact that justice is done. I mean, that's, you know, that's what we rejoice in. And how many individuals might be eventually saved because of his execution.
And I appreciate the fact that they said that they did watch, now whether they did or not, watch for any sign that he would relent to be captured instead of shot.
I'm not sure if that's true or not, because the latest I've heard is that it turned out he wasn't armed at all when they got into the, so they could have overpowered him without shooting him. Even if he had resisted.
His wife stepped in front of him.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right.
You know, it's obvious that he wanted them to kill him. He didn't want to be taken in.
No,
so, and they said, okay, you get it.